Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the ARC Finance Affording Energy podcast, a regular series in which we talk to leading figures in commerce, finance, and public policy who are working to make modern energy affordable, reliable, and accessible to the billions worldwide that currently live without it. I'm your host, Chris Neidl. On today's episode, we talk with Conrad App, co-founder and CEO of Stima Systems, a Kenya-based energy startup launched in 2010. Stima is one of a growing number of energy companies that offer pay-per-use solar solutions to low-income off-grid customers. But as Conrad explains, there are several aspects to Stima's payment model that make their approach somewhat unique. Group-based microleasing leverages the mechanics and growing popularity of community-based savings groups to mitigate client and company risk, contain operating costs, and promote reliable, long-term product performance. In this conversation, we'll hear about the history and evolution of Stima's approach, find out more about the company's energy products and technology. We'll also gain insight into Stima's plans for the future and its aim to expand its customer base and impact in the greater East African region. Please stay tuned and enjoy. The Affording Energy podcast and the episode that you're about to hear have been made possible with generous support from the City Foundation. So right now I'm joined by Conrad App, who's the co-founder and CEO of Stima Systems. Conrad, thanks so much for joining the podcast.
Chris, thanks a lot for having me join.
Great. Yeah. So we'll actually go ahead and jump right in. And first, what I'd love to have you do is just give us a bit of a background or a little bit of the sort of the backstory on how Stima Systems started.
Back in 2007, Kenya erupted into political violence after an election. And in the western area of Kenya, a gentleman by the name of James Kimasoy, who's the Justice and Peace, ordered up a bunch of solar chargers, bottles of water, tents to deploy into the affected regions. One of the products that he worked with was for my former company, a small portable solar charger with a light. And he distributed about 1,000 of these solar chargers into western Kenya and saw that that the solar charger and light were directly responsible for bringing some of the people out of poverty. One woman rose to the top of her community by charging cell phones and making about 15 cents per cell phone. Bricklayers were doubling their business because they left their cell phones on. And a little girl rose to the top of her class because she had lighting to be able to do her study in. So it was this impact on the community that James enlisted us back at the company to find out how we could distribute solar chargers to everybody in Western Kenya.
The story that you just relayed there obviously underscores the impact of the technology of off-grid solar. But the really distinct feature of Stima has more to do with the payment system that you've put in place. I think it'd be helpful, actually, if you told us a little bit about your own personal professional history, because I know that your own experiences in telecom, I think, led you to a lease-based model rather than a product retail-based model. If you could just give us a little bit of background.
So I draw upon two backgrounds coming into Stima. One was rural telecom and mobile micropayments. For the past 20 years, I've been working with mobile phone carriers like Safaricom and their parent company, Vodafone, in bringing mobile payments into value-added services for individuals. So we're about 5 years ago, before I joined my previous solar company, I was working with Vodafone, and Vodafone said the next big opportunity is going to be energy. Vodafone at the time was claiming that 50% of the world had a cell phone, and that over the next 4 to 5 years, coming up around now, 2012, that 75% of the world would have a mobile phone. That additional 25% of the population, however, doesn't have energy and doesn't have the income to be able to, to pay for for service and in some cases energy. So, the problem was posed to me: what's out there in terms of options to be able to reach that rural audience that doesn't have energy? And it was at that time that I jumped ship from my mobile background and joined one of the most popular portable solar charger companies, and took on this initiative with the solar company, specifically partner with telecom and bring solar chargers to telecom subscribers. So for a couple of those years, we worked with Safaricom in Kenya, as well as India and other countries, and launched solar chargers along with the phones, and created a real low-cost bundle so that a person could buy a new low-end phone and get a solar charger with it. That's what brought me into this environment. It failed. It failed because rural users don't buy phones. They might have two or three phone numbers, two or three SIM cards, but they share the hardware with up to seven different people. So they're not buying new phones, and so they weren't buying these bundles. Instead, what they have is they have 10 to 15 year old small Nokia chocolate bar phones. So this is the audience that you're working with, and trying to supply a product through telecom to this audience just simply doesn't work. They don't have the purchasing power to buy a product.
And we'll talk in just a bit about how that that led you more in the direction of a lease-based model. But if we could just actually pause, and if you could give us a little bit more detail about your customers that you were just alluding to more generally about their incomes and their conditions.
Yeah, so these are rural off-grid households with about seven people in a family. They live in a mud hut, thatch roof. They make about $1.50 to about $4 a day, with most of our customers around $2 to $3 a day.
And is there in terms of their energy habits? These I would imagine are pretty consistent kerosene users. But could you give us some more details in terms of the types of energy that they use currently?
Yeah, so inside their house, they have two small tin can lamps that they buy in the market for about 10 cents each. They're made out of recycled beer cans and Coca-Cola cans. They burn about a third of a liter of kerosene a night, which gives them 4 hours of fairly dim light. One of them is in the kitchen where the mom is cooking and cleaning, and the other one's in the dining room where they'll eat dinner by the light. They'll do 2 hours of studies at night, and then they may have an hour to 2 hours of conversation afterwards around the light. Twice a week, they're charging 1.5 mobile phones in the household, and they're walking about 2 to 3 hours into an urban center or into a village center, charging the phone for 2 hours and then walking back. So it's a full half day, and it costs 25 cents each time to charge their phone. And then the final payment is in disposable batteries for a recharge for a battery. In all, it's about $2.70 a week that they're paying on energy.
Okay, so now you've developed a portable charger, which we're going to actually have some photos included in the podcast notes that our listeners can take a look at. And obviously, they can also take a trip to your website, which we'll have linked. But tell us a little bit about the product that you've developed. You've obviously developed it specifically to displace those conventional sources and to obviously offer superior performance. I would imagine some savings. So tell us a little bit about the product that you developed.
So we have a small 2-watt solar charger with an internal battery and a charge control circuit. Into that solar charger, you plug in accessories like lights and phone charging tips or USB radios. In order to be able to offer it on a pay-as-you-go model, there's a chip inside the solar charger that's integrated into the charge control circuits. After 1 week, it shuts off, and it requires a USB key to turn back on for another week.
Okay, so let's then get into this other aspect, which I think there's a lot of solar products that are on the market, a lot of them that have probably somewhat similar specifications to what your product has. But what's really sets Steam apart, I think, is the particular pay-as-you-go model that you have, this group micro-leasing model. Can you just tell us a little bit about why it is that you're pursuing a lease model? There are other similar size products with similar capabilities on the market, but are usually sold for retail. So why is Steemo focused really on a lease model rather than just a product retail model?
Yeah, well, Chris, let me just say first that when the solar charger was free after the post-election violence, it distributed immediately into the communities. Everybody wanted one, and it quickly became used. When later we tried to sell it, the brakes went on, and nobody was buying these solar chargers. So we realized very quickly that money is a barrier to adopting affordable energy. Although the users can make considerable money off the solar charger once they have it, they weren't able to buy it up front. So that was the big learning right away that, whereas we saw a huge demand, we saw zero demand when we put a price tag on it.
What was that price tag, Conrad, or what was the range, I guess, in prices that those were being offered for?
Well, to be profitable, it would need to be around $40 to $50 just to at least pay for itself in the importation. But we tried everything down to $5, and putting as much as $5 on the price of the solar charger just as a test caused people to think about it for weeks. So it greatly stopped its ability to get adopted. We want to be able to offer a service that is much like electricity that their higher income counterparts enjoy, which is on a monthly basis they're buying energy, and so we're offering a service where it's a permanent service, and for that service we repair the products, we replace them, and we continue to give them accessories that they can use in it.
And in this lease arrangement, tell me a little bit about, obviously they're getting, it's a big upgrade in terms of the LED lights that you are providing from kerosene. They can now charge their mobile phones at home and then potentially even power small radios. So what are the actual savings, though, that your customers are realizing through this lease on a weekly, monthly basis?
So on a weekly basis, it's $1.70. So they pay us $1 per week. And they save $2.70 in kerosene, phone charging, and disposable batteries.
Okay. So now the lease, I mean, leasing has been attempted with low-income folks in the energy space for some time in different parts of the world with some mixed results, some attempts more successful than others. But what I think is really, really interesting about what you do is this group basis, which I'd love to have you describe.
Yeah, Chris, so we experienced mixed results as well. And over a four-year period of pilots and working with low-income users, we have some pretty black and white comparisons to make in terms of payments. When we initially started, we offered the solar chargers to individuals, folks that were spending $2.70 a week on energy, and the value proposition was pay us $1 a week, and you'll have energy as well as the lights and the accessories as for as long as you make the payments. Counter to logic, users stopped paying us, and their units stopped working as well, and they went back onto kerosene. And the main reason they went back onto kerosene is that kerosene for them offered the attractiveness of smaller payments. They could pay on a daily basis for as much light that they wanted. And then the second reason is that the individuals that we worked with at that income level have very spiky income, and they would go through periods where they had no means to be able to buy food for the kids. So they would sell the product. They might get $3 or $4 for it. The purchaser of the product might be a cell phone shack, and they might be interested just in the battery. But the proposition of giving $3 to a user, a low income household when they were in need, was enough for them to sell the product. So we found that when we worked with the individuals, that we only received 20% payment at best, and that we in no circumstances were we able to get the units back. When we tried to get the units back, they simply said that they had either sold them or they lost them. So our experience working with individuals, even though they need the product, even though they spend more for the product, is that the best case scenario is 20% will pay.
Okay, so then where you find yourselves now is that you basically structure leases only with groups of 8 to 20 people. Okay, so if you could tell us a little bit about how you happened upon sort of that discovery or that shift in the model? And really, what have been the consequences of the results of that shift?
Yeah, so about a year and a half into the pilots with individuals, trying various different payment structures, working with women versus men, working with certain incomes versus others, out of Western Kenya in a small little town, we were getting 100% payment for every unit. And so what we typically did is jump in a Jeep, go there and visit the household and find out what's happening. To our surprise, we found a group of 20 women that were part of a savings internal loan committee set up by the Catholic Church. That was this group of women all had a solar charger and were paying consistently, and they paid as a unit. They would collect everybody's money and send it in to us via M-Pesa. It was 100% payment, and it was continuous.
So that just literally bubbled up from the users. That was something that you discovered in the field, and that was a sort of an adaptation or a payment mechanism that users more or less put into place, and then you replicated it based on that success.
Yeah, we started about 50. We took this key and we handed it out to about 50 different individuals through various channels, through the Catholic Church, through World Vision, and then we found individuals in communities that we worked with, and they all went out and they found their best markets, best way to make a business out of this. And it was the Savings Internal Loan Committees that had this habit of women coming together and investing into opportunities, group buying food. And it was this Savings Internal Loan Committee that really changed our minds as to how to work with individuals.
Okay, and I want to get right into the details of that, because there's so many different aspects of it that are really interesting with groups. It's not just that you have increased repayment, but that you have, it's sort of a screening mechanism for selecting clients. But before we do that, let's just make sure that our listeners have a very clear sense of how that part of the technology works. So we know that we're dealing with portable lighting devices, charging devices, but tell a little bit about the key activation, deactivation as well.
Sure. In a model, if there's a solidarity group, a group where everybody is guaranteeing each other's performance in the group, each one of those individuals gets a solar charger, a light, and charging tips. And on a weekly basis, they're asked to come together in one meeting, collect everyone's payment, and then send us the payment via M-Pesa. And if they do that, a receipt goes back to a person who has the key. We call that person an agent, and the agent reactivates everybody's device. If one person doesn't pay and the total comes up to one payment short, no one is reactivated. And so that forces the group to cover everyone's payment. And typically what we see is that 20% of the group members can't pay during that week. Their income is such that they don't have the money. Or they had better uses for that money. So we expect that 20% won't pay, but the group will pay for them. And then in the subsequent week, the group will work out on their own terms how to get the money back from the user. And typically they get the user the money back from that user, sometimes with interest. And if they don't, they simply take the charger back from that individual and they give it to someone else. So with a group, the group is able to manage a collection of payments for us.
What's one of the things that's very interesting about that, I think, is that the group itself has this, obviously, a joint liability dynamic where anybody who participates has, they're compelled, obviously, to pay because everybody else is sort of on the line. If they don't pay, then nobody's systems get turned back on. So that's kind of almost like a discipline that's imposed by the model. But there's also, I think, that there's a clear flexibility that it grants as well. That it seems that, tell me if this is true, is that while every week you might have a few people who don't pay, those are probably different people every week. So that anybody who participates can kind of expect, I guess, that at some point they might not have the money and the rest of their peers in the group can sort of cover their costs. Is that sort of what you're seeing?
Yeah, it's exactly that. So energy, you know, a user might have a good reason why they can't pay that week. And if we were working with them as an individual, they would not pay us. And they would take that money that they otherwise had or didn't have, and they would put it towards another use. When they're in a group, the group does the cash smoothing for them. So for everybody, over time, affordable energy makes a lot more sense than buying kerosene. On an individual week basis for an individual, it may not. It may be better to not pay us and to use that money to feed a kid or to get on a bus to sell some product to make some money. So on an individual weekly basis for an individual, it may not make sense to pay us. But on a group level, chances are several of the members see the benefit that week and can cover for other people. So it's absolutely necessary to have a group of people because in general, it makes sense to have affordable energy. But at a particular moment in time for a particular individual, it may make sense not to pay and to use that money elsewhere.
So I think that there's a couple things going on here with the groups is that you have first of all, it does allow members to have some amount of flexibility. If they can't pay because of circumstances that week, then the group will cover for them, and they can expect to do the same when other members of their group have the same issues. But it also seems that the groups themselves or the individuals that participate, they know better than you ever would who the people who are most likely to repay are. So in some ways, the groups themselves, because they're self-formed, seem to kind of create a screening function for you. Is that right?
Yeah, so they provide a screening function for us. They recruit people that they trust, whom trust them. And they also know how to get the money back from that user and how to get that person to pay. Or if they can't pay this week, how to get that person to pay the group in the subsequent week. So they know much better than we do who's a reliable payer and how to get that person to pay.
Okay, and let's actually talk about these groups that we keep referring to. Many of our listeners will be familiar with savings groups, and they go by many different names in different parts of Africa. But they're clearly a informal vehicle for finance, for savings, for credit in rural areas of East and West Africa. So from where you stand, I mean, since your model now is really tied to these groups, or at least familiarity with these groups, or local know-how on how to form groups, tell us a little bit about group formation and what they do, how important they are, how many of them are in the target market where you're operating.
So just taking Kenya, there's 42 million people in the country, and there's about 1 million people who are part of microfinance. In microfinance in Kenya, everybody's part of a group. Groups are 10 to 20 people. There's the Catholic Church that has catechists that are individuals that go around and start savings internal loan committees, which they call silk groups. We estimate there's about 500,000 people that are part of groups in Kenya that are related to the Catholic Church. World Vision and several NGOs work with small farmers and individuals to do fish co-ops and tree farms and various initiatives, and they're deployed through groups as well. So the seeds will go to a group of individuals, or the tools to build the pond or to harvest the crop will be distributed to a group on with very similar conditions. And there's you know, tens of thousands of these groups. Those are, you know, three types of groups that are controlled through a hierarchy of an organization, either a microfinance organization, an NGO, or a Catholic church. In addition to those, families between, you know, $1.50 to $4 are commonly organizing themselves in informal groups. So neighbors will get together, and typically they're women, similar to the Catholic Church and the NGOs and the microfinance. They're typically women will get together with several neighbors, and they agree to help smooth each other's income. Because income spike, their costs are about a dollar a day for food and energy, and their income does not come in on a daily basis. When their income comes in, they distribute it amongst the group, and then vice versa. When they need to make payments and they don't have the income, they draw from the group. So this, we believe, is fairly pervasive throughout, well over half the population that falls into this income bracket in Kenya. But it's hard to reach them through any type of formal organization. To reach these ones, we have to work at the village level through a village chief or village elder to find out who's part of groups.
Do you have formal partnerships or relationships with some of the larger organizations that do promote savings groups, the World Visions, the Catholic Church? Or at this point, are you sort of working solo, engaging with groups directly?
We do a combination of channels. So right now we have a partnership with the Justice and Peace out of the Diocese of Eldoret, which has 6 million rural low-income families under their jurisdiction. And the Justice and Peace is regularly reaching out to these rural families through NGOs, through churches, to be able to bring the population under the political process, to be able to bring relief services, to be able to bring education and lighting and other things that the Catholic believes are life enhancing programs and services. And so it's through that hierarchy, the Justice and Peace, that we're able to reach down into the rural village, meet with village elders, and then find these groups. And then we also work with World Vision in a partnership to get to the fish farms and the tree co-ops and the coffee plantations where groups of users are working. And then in pilots, we've worked through Cadet, which is a microfinance institution, and we plan to do that again in the future. So all of these organizations can help us reach a good large percentage of people who are in groups.
Tell me actually about the structure of STEMA itself and your agent and super agent network, because I think that's a really, really interesting, innovative aspect of your model as well, about how it is that you make sure that you got the proper incentives for your own staff to deliver service on a regular basis. So give us a little sketch of how that works currently.
Yes. So starting with the users, there will be 10 users in a group, and that group will meet in a spot on a weekly basis and interface with an agent. That agent is from the same income group. They're typically $2 to $3, maybe $4 a day. They're provided a key, and initially they're provided up to 10 solar chargers to distribute that to the Now, we want that agent to grow to 10 groups, so a good 100 users that they would be working with. So imagine as the organization scales, there's going to be 100 users to every agent. And then that agent on a regular basis needs to go back to a master agent. The agent has a key which will expire, and we do that for several reasons. One, we don't want the agent to bypass the payment system and take cash directly from the users and not report back to us. So we have their key expire on a monthly basis. Secondly, because they're constantly growing their groups, and they start with 10, end up with 100. They need to come back and pick up more units and then deploy those to additional groups. And then the products themselves break, so they need to be able to have a backward channel to bring those products back to our master agent. So a master agent will work with up to 30 agents and will hold stock. We'll have computers to reprogram those keys. We'll have additional units to replace. And we'll manage those agents and give them training and give them guidance. So an organization with that we have starts with a master agent that controls 30 agents, and then each one of those agents will have up to somewhere between 10 and 100 users in 1 to 10 different groups.
Now, are either the super agents or the agents, their relationship with STEMA, are they working on a commission basis, or are they salaried, or what exactly are the relationships there?
Yeah, it's a 100% commission basis. So an agent that is interested in participating with STEMA, we usually find them through a village chief or through an NGO organization, will be given a key and 10 solar charts at no cost to them. And they typically already have a group in mind, either their friends, their family, or people that are immediately working with them that have told them in advance that they would pay $1 a week. So typically, they already have some customers in mind. They feel fairly confident that they can get that $1 a week from these individuals, and they receive 25% commissions on each one of those payments. So for a group of 10 individuals, that's $2.50 a week, which, for a small amount of work is a nice chunk of income. If you get up to 10 users, that's $20 a week, which is a nice $4 a day income that they're able to generate. And compared to local incomes, that's right at the top of the base of the pyramid. And in addition to other types of jobs that they may have, that helps them move up, several dollars in income on a daily basis beyond where they were before. And then secondly, the master agent gets 5% commission. So with 3,000. With up to 3,000 individuals, that could be a very nice income. The master agent is from a different income segment. They do have electricity. They're in a semi-urban, peri-urban environment. They can use a computer. They have experience with a computer. They have access to an internet connection, and they're looking for a much higher income. They can travel, they can visit rural areas. They do have access to transportation. So those are the two that are on strict commission, and then management is on and management employees that are supporting those organizations or supporting the development of the NGO and microfinance partnerships are on a salary.
And right now you have so just to clarify there that the master agents are recruiting and training the agents. They're holding the stock of the equipment. They also have a laptop, I believe, where I think one of the things that's interesting about the key model that you use, not only does it activate the chargers, but it also extracts some data from those devices themselves, right? Can you tell us a little bit about that, about how that information is pulled and what it's used for?
Yeah, so there's a this is our what we call our sneaker net, our most basic, information, our IT infrastructure, which is very simple. A solar charger has a chip inside of it that records all its activity, how much energy goes into the battery and how much energy leaves that battery. It also tells us what time during the day that occurs. It also tells us if a key is inserted into the solar charger. So we could tell if the agent is inserting the key into the solar charger at the weekly meeting, and we could look at every charger in that group and see, for example, that there is a consistent meeting that happens where everybody's involved. That information is important for us for several reasons. When that agent comes back to the master agent and says, "My first group of 10 people were successful, give me another 30 units," or "My first 50 users were successful, give me another 50 units. The master agent is able to take that key, that USB key, insert it into the computer, and look at several things. First thing is are all the users using this on a daily basis? We don't want the case where an agent comes back and says, "Well, I've got my first 10 users are all successful. Here's my key," and we find out that only 4 of the users are using it. Maybe he sold those other 6 units for $3 each and is making up the payments over M-Pesa. So if we see that everybody is using those units, we know that they were distributed. Second thing is we want to see that that group is a solidarity group. Are they meeting at the same time, in the same location, at the same time during the week? If we see one person's being reactivated on Tuesday and another person's being reactivated on Thursday and another one on Saturday, that leads us to believe that that's not a solidarity group. And when they run into problems, they're not going to be able to help each other out. So we want to look at those two things. And then the third thing that is helpful for us is it tells us, is our battery big enough? Do we need to offer more accessories? That's important. And Chris, there's a fourth feature of the technology transfer, and that is the key. The key has an LCD screen on it, and it has buttons. And when that key is inserted into a charger during the group meeting, we have an opportunity to ask a very simple yes-no question. Do you want a radio? Or do you have a bicycle? Or do you want an extra light? And when it's inserted into that user's charger, the agent will ask that person that same yes or no question and then respond yes or no into the device. It gets loaded into the key, and then a month later when the agent goes back to the master agent, the master agent, in addition to validating that the agent is running a good business, sees that, oh yes, you could use an extra three lights and one extra radio. And then some marketing information goes back to SEMA so that we can find out, you know, other things about the user's life. So we use that to be able to do our inventory and in subsequent delivery of units to that master agent, we can provide those products that were requested. Hmm. So an extra radio might be, you know, an extra 10 cents a week to that group.
Interesting. So you're basically combining payment monitoring, technical monitoring, but you're building in basically simple market research in there as well to find out what specifically customer demand would be. And you're able to get that type of feedback. So that even, I guess, in the long term sort of will help inform your future design process too.
Correct.
Interesting. So let's just go back real quickly and look again at the group thing is really sort of a gift that keeps on giving. It's not just what we've discussed, it seems, in terms of the you know, risk mitigation with repayment and client selection. But in our couple conversations we had before, it seems like there's some other benefits that you've discovered from it as well. One that I found that was really interesting was what you had talked about with you don't have to require any down payment or fee because of the effectiveness of groups, basically, enhancing payment. Can you tell me a little bit about how you discovered that and the value of that, I guess, in terms of attracting customers?
Yeah, Chris, you know, when you're working with the poorest people in the world and you ask them for money, you need to go to them and you need to sell them on why they need to give the money to you. And that takes time. They need to think it over. They need to talk to their community because they are part of communities. And in order to get that upfront money, they would need to borrow it from their own existing groups. So on one hand, if you're trying to take money from people in this income segment, that requires a lot of resources, a lot of selling, and you convince them why they need to do that. The alternative is make it free, no upfront fee. And they come to you, and they come to you, and they explain why they should receive this product. They give you their friends' names and the people that they would bring into the group. So on one hand, you're selling to them, and you're convincing them to give you their money. And on the other hand, they're convincing you why they're going to be a good customer. And the second one is a lot easier to deploy, market, and collect customers through, since they're motivated to motivated to work with you.
So in addition to your the groups playing the central role in your payment model, it seems like they're also really pivotal for your recruitment.
Yeah, recruitment is one of the nicest parts of the group, and the way it actually happens is we'll have existing groups that are meeting with an agent in a village, and they typically do this at the Pepsi stand, the Coke stand, or the church, or a schoolhouse, and other individuals in the village will see the group's meeting, and they'll want to be part of the service. They get to see the lights at night, they get to see people charging phones, so they want to be part of it, and they approach the agent, and they say, can I get one of these STEMA units, and I'll pay a dollar a week. And the STEMA agent says, no, sorry, we don't work with individuals. Come back with at least 9 other individuals that you trust that want the service and that can, agree to group payments. And so that individual will come back with 9 individuals, and they're instructed to sit in the same group formation at the same Coke stand or the same schoolhouse or church meeting spot. And if the agent sees them meeting there for 2 to 3 weeks in a row, and everybody's on time, and no one's late, and no one's talking out of order in those groups, that agent says, well, that looks like a solidarity group. That looks like they can control the group. They don't have individuals that are showing up late, so they must have control over the individuals. They're not talking loud, so they seem to have control over themselves. And the agent takes down their names and brings it back to the master agent and says, they've been meeting for 2 to 3 weeks. They look like they're pretty good. I trust them. They seem to know each other. So let's go ahead and give them some units. And that's how our system works. The group, instead of working with one individual, that agent is now working with 10 individuals. So it's 10 times easier.
And I know that you did some experimentation early on, too, as well as far as what the repayment schedules are going to be like. And what you use now, it seems like it's sort of a Goldilocks type of thing where the 1 week repayment seems to be just right. I know that you tried everyday payments, once a month, every 2 weeks. Tell us a little bit about what you found there and why it is that the 1 week model seems to work particularly well.
Yeah, the weekly model is a balance between the ideal, which would be a daily model, and our ideal, which would be a monthly model. And let me just say what the ideal would be. Today, they spend 30 cents a day every day on kerosene. And then twice a week, they spend their 25 cents on their phone charging. They would like to be able to do the same thing with affordable energy. But we can't afford to do that. It's expensive to use M-Pesa. To get that transaction, it costs us about 15 cents to receive that payment, which on a daily basis, we'd want to charge somewhere close to 15 cents as well for the energy. So that doesn't make sense. And then on a monthly basis, they can't save up the money that long. Money is burning a hole in your pocket in rural Kenya. If you have 15 cents in your pocket, sitting in your pocket, it adds no value. A person does not hold on to their money in at these income levels, and asking for a large payment at the end of the month is impossible for this group. What we found is that a week is a nice balance between what they really want to do, pay on a weekly on a daily basis, and our lowest possible cost, which would be to receive money on a monthly basis.
We will be discussing so far is that. The group is the means by which the money is pooled and is ultimately paid, but it has to get to you in some cost-effective way. And obviously, you're making use of M-Pesa, which is widespread in Kenya. But it seems also that the groups really, because they're groups, they make M-Pesa affordable for the group members. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so when an individual is part of a group of 10 other people, the payment transaction is the same. It's 15 cents. It doesn't matter if you're sending us one individual payment or 10 individual or 10 payments all combined. That 15 cents now spread over 10 times as many individuals. So for the individuals, that's great. They're spending less money on transactions. And then for us, that's great because our users, more of the users' money can go to us rather than transaction fees. So the group helps reduce those, makes that transaction fee a much smaller form of the payment. Imagine if it was just an individual, 15% of the weekly payment would be in transactions. Whereas on a group level of 10 or more individuals, it's 1.5% less.
One thing I'd like to talk about actually is, we mentioned a little bit at the beginning, when you're serving rural customers in the last mile, so to speak, and you're marketing electronic products, the issue of quality of ongoing service is a huge one. As we've already discussed, the leasing model is an ongoing, relationship that helps ensure that systems don't break down. But could you give us a little bit more detail about your approach to technical service or after-sales service, how you ensure that customers day in, day out have consistent service and that breakdowns aren't an issue?
So breakdowns will happen. These are electronic devices. The batteries are exposed to extreme heat. It's extreme usage. They're putting in the sun 6 to 8 hours a day. and they're using it 4 to 8 hours in the evenings, or at least with several different devices. So it's 100% usage of this product, and it's carried around in dusty areas, and occasionally it drops. And then of course there's torrential rains that will happen, and so we see quite a bit of that. So the products will break. And so the way that we make sure that we have consistent services is that everyone in the group gets one unit, and the agent gets an extra unit. And that unit is free for the agent to use for personal use. But once there's a problem in the group, that unit becomes the loaner unit. And we have 3 days to get, if there's another person in the group that also breaks a unit, we have 3 days to replace that person's unit before the week is free to that user. So our goal is to get that agent to come back to us and replace that. So the way this works is the agent takes the unit back to the master agent. Ideally, that agent's going to be picking up more units and making use out of this trip, reactivating the key or getting other types of valuable things in return. The unit goes back to the master agent. The master agent takes it back to Steema, and there's 3 things that we do to that unit. First failure point is going to be the battery, so we can replace the battery for $3. The second failure point is the electronics. Rain gets on the electronics and dust, so the entire PCB could be destroyed. We replace the PCB. And then the third possibility is the solar panels are scratched and blurred. So it's one of those 3 things that we're typically seeing for repair. And in and out, we can get the unit repaired and refurbished and sent back for about $7. So for us, this is a very attractive service. Buy a brand new unit, import it into Kenya at close to $25, or take a broken unit, refurbish it, and put it back into the system for about $7. For this, we want to be in this business of owning the customer and providing them perpetual service, because it's cheaper for them, it's cheaper for us, and batteries don't get disposed improperly in rural villages.
Right. Well, let's also, you just brought up a point about, the ongoing relationship between Steema and its customers. And that could be just status quo, where it's the same product that they have, the charger that you currently market, and day in, day out, week after week, they pay for that service. But I know as a company, it looks like you're obviously collecting data about customers, you're collecting data about their demands and their aspirations in terms of energy. What is it that you really sort of, how do you see that relationship evolving over time in terms of the different types of products that you're going to offer, the different types of services that you're going to offer?
Yeah, you hinted at this before earlier in the conversation. We're not an energy company. We're not a solar product company. What we are, asset leasing company. We see a ongoing relationship with folks at the bottom of the base of the pyramid that can't afford to buy products that could either help them save money or make them money. Obviously, solar lighting and phone charging help save them money, but there are other products like water purification, maybe sewing machines, maybe other types of electronics that could help them make money. So we want to understand what our customers need and deliver them any type of asset that they otherwise couldn't purchase, and put it into a relationship where it's affordable for them to acquire, and it's affordable and secure for us to deliver to them. So we imagine that, for example, with a group of 10 individuals, we could have every individual in that group using a solar charger, and then maybe 2 of those people in the group. Group is a strong performing group, and they have a nice history with us. We could have 2 individuals in that group that say, "I'd like a sewing machine," and if we trust that group, we could deliver them a sewing machine. It doesn't have to necessarily be controlled by our key, or it could be an electronic sewing machine that is controlled by our key. But if we trust the group, We can give a product to that group in addition to the solar chargers and trust that we'll be paid for it. And if they didn't pay us for that sewing machine, we simply wouldn't reactivate their solar chargers. So we want a situation where we have everybody in the group in some type of position where if we stop the service, it's a considerable incentive for them to cause the entire group to pay for us. Initially, we do imagine other types of electronic key control devices, like water purification, maybe irrigation, those types of products. But we envision that we could provide any type of product that helps save or make money a target segment.
So what is it now? You're in early in year three of Steema's existence. What are you looking at right now? You're operating in the Great Rift Valley region of Kenya. In terms of your growth or your projections, and also some of your, I guess you could say your product diversification. What do you see over the next 1 to 2 years for Steema?
We see continued focus on Kenya. In the same target segments focused around the basic solar charger with the accessories being light, phone charging, and FM radio. We don't see leaving Kenya for at least another couple of years. We need to get a very stable, strong base of users. We have a lot to work through, but our eyes are on expanding out into East Africa initially, and then eventually into greater sub-Saharan Africa. And then product-wise, we were open to additional solar chargers, larger systems, more energy, and then larger accessories and appliances that might plug in under the same model. We do see ourselves focused on the group model. The group model is going to be a core focus of anything that we do. Although we can expand across borders, and we could expand up the value chain into larger products.
Well, Conrad, we will definitely look forward to following your success in the future, and wish you the best of luck, and definitely hope that you'll join us for a future podcast.
Thank you very much, Chris. And again, thanks a lot for reaching out to Steema.
Our pleasure. I hope you enjoyed this installment of the ARC Finance Affording Energy podcast. To listen to past and future episodes and to find out more about ARC Finance's global projects, please visit us at www.arcfinance.org.